Hey, thanks to everyone who donated to our Patreon campaign so far. If you would like to donate and get some real cool free shit, go to patreon.com/lastpodcast on the left.
There's no place to escape to.
This is the last podcast
on the left.
That's when the cannibalism started.
Are we still young, or are we old? I know my dad, if he could, would walk around with a mirror taped to his shoe, walking around looking up girls' skirts and doing pranks in the back of a bus. I know that he would.
All right, welcome to the last podcast on the left, everyone. I am Ben Kissel, staring at the beautiful Marcus Parks.
Hey-o.
With us, as always, Henry Zabrowski. Henry! Henry!
Sorry, I'm just the sheriff of the Houston Police Department. Oh, I didn't hear a rich man get murdered. That's fun. That's commentary.
No, poor people got killed. Don't worry about it. Go back to sleep.
So fast. Only to have the ease of mind of a sheriff of Houston.
Oh, yeah. Just the lack of concern. We're on to part two of Dean Corll.
Oh, yeah. And this is the part where we're going to find out just how this man, along with two accomplices, killed 28 kids, mostly in the same neighborhood, over a period of just 3 years. A berserker kill streak that lasted 3 years.
Highly organized, kept under secret, and also, to be honest, if we're looking at prime real estate of victims, too, of being like strong young men, and like they are going missing off the street, and nobody thought to look about them because they just thought everybody was going to join the carnival like it's fucking Pinocchio.
Right.
And nobody's going to. There is no magical carnival. There is no something wicked this way comes carnival. I wish there was,
because
I would be there.
Yeah. 28 kills in 3 years. Ask yourself, what are you doing to achieve your dreams? My God.
Well, I hope to go to DeVry for toilet repair.
For toilet repair? That's a job that never goes out of business. As a matter of fact, if my child wanted to do that, I'd be all in.
Yep. Toilet prepare. That's what I do. I make sure that the bolts are tight, because there's nothing worse when you sit down in a toilet and the toilet seat gets all swivelly.
That's a great job.
Now, to this day, Houston is no stranger to crime, ranking number 3 on the FBI's Most Dangerous Cities in Texas report that was released just last year. But specifically, Houston has a long and storied history in the crime of murder. Mm. In 1957, Houston had the highest per capita murder rate in the country, earning the rapidly growing metropolis the nickname Murder City.
Gotta move there.
Yeah. Honey, should we move to Tulsa or Utah or Murder City?
Well, which is the city that's got murder in the title of it? Because as you know, I am a murderer, and I hope to achieve higher degrees of success in my hierarchy of murder.
Well, Daryl, we're going to Texas.
Woo!
Yeah.
In 1966, before Houston had even a million people, the city had 5 dozen more victims of homicide than in all of England, which had a population of 54 million.
Because, and that's why we kicked those wussies out of this country.
That's right.
In 1970, the year in which Corll began his 3-year murder spree, Houston had dropped from number 1 to number 3 in the highest murder rate per capita in the nation, being surpassed only by Dallas and Atlanta.
Hmm.
At one point, as mayor of Houston, when the numbers kind of drop, it's like when you're number one in only one thing,
right?
Any slip in whatever the category is makes you very upset.
That's right. As mayor of Houston, I guarantee we get the murder rates back to number one.
He starts handing chainsaws out to postal workers.
You get a chainsaw. You get a chainsaw.
In his 1971 book, Houston, the Once and Future City, author George Fuhrman recorded a popular limerick that was going around the city at the time.
In Houston, we feel no aversion when others are casting aspersion. We never mind much, the murders and such. We take them as a weekend diversion.
So what did it take to make Texans do poetry? Murder. It just took mass murder, and they're like, I think we're going to get into poetry.
Oh, I'm also very upset that New York doesn't have a limerick that we all know about it.
So you're asking, why was murder so prevalent in Houston? There's a myriad of reasons. One, the town still very much had a frontier spirit about it, with all of the violence that comes along with such a spirit.
But it still was a modern city in modern times.
Right, can you have a frontier spirit if there's a supermarket right down the street?
Were barbers still surgeons?
Right.
Were they still just, if you had a cut, would a guy splash moonshine on it and be like, get out of here, faggot?
Yeah, I feel like they just used that as an
excuse. I'm a boy, I have lymphoma. Just dumping bourbon all over his head.
I went to the doctor with lymphoma and he just gave me a bowl cut.
Well, yeah, I mean, it wasn't that far removed. I mean, you still had cowboys and Indians. You still had guys riding on horses up until the 1910s. You guys have played Red Dead Redemption. You know how that goes.
Yes, I remember that when Houston turned into zombies.
1865, the year was Red Dead Redemption was set in.
No.
This is 1970, blah, blah, blah.
They had a Kmart. They had red light or blue light specials to go to.
Well, of course, not just did it add the frontier spirit, it also had a ridiculously high gun ownership rate. In fact, the vast majority of deaths in Houston were by gun. Or not deaths, murders. The vast majority of murders in Houston were by gun.
The city was exploding.
Yeah.
The book, The Man with the Candy, really illustrates this beautifully at the beginning. It's really awesome. But he was talking about how there was all of this, not only oil money, but every sort of industry in the world was moving there. It was gigantic. The Astrodome was built. All of those huge, they called it the eighth wonder of the world. Mm-hmm. All these crazy construction projects happening. And so at one point, happened in New York City, there was a gigantic influx of money in there, which of course immediately sets off the statuses of everybody. That makes the poor extra, extra poor and the rich extra, extra rich.
Shades of H.H. Holmes as well, right?
Somewhat. And this sort of thing is still happening in Texas to this day. It's happening in Midland, Odessa right now. Midland, Odessa is in the middle of a big oil boom. Guess what the most dangerous city in Texas is right now? Odessa.
Oh.
This happens over and over again. This is definitely a pattern in the state of Texas.
Well, I'm just so happy. This is the episode where I found the name for my firstborn daughter, Odessa. Odessa Kissel, come over here.
I can just imagine your hunched back 270-pound daughter.
What is it, Dad?
Oh, you're beautiful to me, Odessa. Why don't you go run around nude in the street, see if you can find a husband? Okay. Mr. Kissel, we've returned your daughter.
Well, really, the biggest problem in Houston was their grossly understaffed police force. In 1970, cops in Houston numbered 2,200 in a city of 1.3 million, half the absolute minimum required to police such a population. And in addition to being understaffed, the force was also underpaid, with many cops having to take outside jobs to make ends meet. But the biggest injustice is that this was a problem that had a very easy, very simple solution. Federal funds to beef up the force were readily available, but Police Chief Herman Short, high on that frontier spirit, refused any and all assistance, calling any federal assistance whatsoever a quote-unquote handout.
A true American.
I like this guy. So it must be interesting if you're on the police force one morning, but then at night, you're the garbage man.
Yeah.
So like someone would be like, I need some help, officer. I've been robbed. He's like, yeah, I'm here to pick up trash. Get back to me in 8 hours when I'm on my cop shift.
Sorry, I'm on no sleep whatsoever. I left a badge on. This badge is useless while I'm a garbage man. Just these garbage lifting hands are the only thing I can use, but I still carry my gun.
Isn't that something?
I shoot the tires.
And, not surprisingly, Herman Short, the police chief who, refused all these federal funds, he resigned pretty shortly after Dean Curl's body count broke the previous record of 25 that was set a couple years earlier by murderer of migrants, Juan Corona, who we're definitely going to cover.
Again, accept what you're best at. Be like, I'm the number one sheriff at letting 29 young, strong men get murdered in my city.
Yeah.
Something.
No, because of that staff problem, the workload that officers faced was so stacked that a lot of them just threw up their hands and gave up, which is a very human reaction. You're faced with this overwhelming workload. You don't know where to start. It just keeps coming in. You just stop.
Mm-hmm.
You just can't approach it whatsoever. And cops even started making a game to see who could leave work the earliest.
Because they would see who could leave the work earliest, and then they would pass the buck of different, like, basically, if they got an assignment for the day, they would just leave it on somebody else's desk as they were walking out. Also, homicide, which is really interesting, also had to cover 55 other types of crime.
56.
It's insane. They literally had to sit and they were covering, like, treason, like all this, like, ridiculous right. horseshit that they had to cover all at once, and so murder was the last thing they were looking at.
Well, they had to cover every crime in which greed was not a motive. So they had assault, battery, rape, not to mention murder. And you know how many homicide detectives they had? 42. 1.3 million people. 42 guys covering every single violence-related crime.
So basically, when you say greed, you mean theft, right?
I mean theft. Yeah. Any sort of theft, anything like that. Like, that was a complete, like, that was beat cops. That was a different division. But homicide was in charge of anything related to violence. And because of this, homicide detectives generally ignored everything that wasn't a murder. Anything and everything that wasn't a murder did not get any attention. In fact, if a woman called up the police, like, hey, my husband's beating me, I need someone to come out, the police would say, like, well, actually, you need to come down to the station to report that. We can't send anyone out there.
Right.
And really, what would happen with the murders, since there were so few people and so many murders, usually the murders didn't even really get that much attention. Those that weren't investigated, they called them misdemeanor murders. And that was reserved for black victims or very poor white victims. And other murders, they would get at the most 2 days of investigation, with most murders only getting an hour or two before the police just moved on.
And honestly, right. half the homicide detectives were actively investigating the murder of JR on Dallas.
That's right. I believe that's true. So basically, the cops would be like, oh, I'm sorry, ma'am. Your husband's murdered. I'm going to do everything I can. Did you do it? Did you do it? Did you do it? Did you do it?
Did you do it? Did you do it? You got a chance? You got two chances to tell me if you did it.
Did you investigate the case?
Yeah.
Did you do it?
Yeah, I did it two times.
You did it twice? Okay.
That's all I can do. That's literally all I can do.
Why don't you change into your garbage man clothes then? You're fine to go.
Look, you know, I figured out how to solve the Rubik's Cube is you just take up all the stickers and put them all the colors on the same side.
Dumb Yankees couldn't figure that out.
Well, the neighborhood where Dean Corll carried out his murder spree was filled with people that would have been classified as misdemeanor murders. One journalist, he said about the Heights, no newsmakers live here, no wealthy, no civic leaders, no socialites. It is a sad, tired place.
I do find interesting about the Heights is the reason why the Heights was called the Heights is that because, I mean, Houston's flat. Yeah. Right. And it was something like only 5 meters above sea line. Mm-hmm. So back in the day, there was these strikeouts of yellow fever. And so what they would do is they would literally be like, let's run to the hills where the fever can't catch us legitimately. And they would go to the Heights because they thought that would make it because that was the highest place in the area. And they thought they would be above the sickness.
You just take a big step up and then you're like, it can't get to me now.
Well, and Jack Olson, author of The Man with the Candy, he described it as a place, quote, where one could imagine retarded children or senile ants locked away in attic crawls, muttering in the shadows.
And what an imagination that is. That's fun.
That's where Marcus grew up.
Isn't that nice?
No. Which one were you, Marcus?
Muttering in the shadows. Definitely. Yeah. But we didn't have an attic in our house, so fuck you, Henry.
Not bad. All right, that's one way to avoid it.
But surprisingly, the Heights was not a high-crime neighborhood. The worst criminal the Heights had seen before Dean Corll was a man that was known locally as the Heights Phantom. And the Phantom's M.O. was to appear naked at the doors of women before running off, cackling into the shadows.
Bye, bye, goodbye, see ya, bye. Woo, 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 woo. Oh, my dowsing rod says there's water in here. Woo, woo, woo. All right, bye.
Ma'am, just have to ask, did he fart as he ran away?
Oh, you know he did.
That's the Phantom.
But it seemed like the fart made him go faster.
That is the Phantom, ma'am.
When the Phantom was captured, he was just as quickly released and told to, quote, pull himself together.
I can imagine a cop just grabbing a guy with no clothes on and just a trench coat on and just, like, ruffling him up by the shirt and be like, come on, all right, get your shit together, all right? Come on, think about what you're doing, okay?
It's like a frustrated father.
And there were criminals in the Heights, of course, thieves and such, but the Heights, there was nothing to steal in the Heights. So the criminals, they would go to other neighborhoods. People would know, like, yeah, you know, Jeff, he steals shit. He's a thief, but he ain't stealing from me, and he ain't stealing from my neighbor.
But they said also,
whatever.
The other thing, too, is that the criminals lived in the Heights. That's like where they lived.
Right.
So they didn't shit where they ate.
Right.
Yeah. And also, the whole town was connected, like, it was very familial. Everybody knew each other for forever, for generation after generation. So it's that common thing where you walk into what is essentially a bad neighborhood. Like in New York, you see a lot, like what Bed-Stuy used to be like, where the Bed-Stuy, everybody assumed, yo, you go there, gonna get mugged, and be like, no, that's just where the muggers live.
Right. This is actually the safest area in town.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing is, even if someone didn't live there forever, just people generally trusted each other. Like, they just didn't really question the motives of other people. As long as you were clean cut, and as long as you didn't embarrass yourself, then you were good. You were welcomed into the community. And as for the teenagers of the Heights, the kids and the parents that had a bit of a gentleman's agreement going on, this is how one kid put it.
As long as we keep up appearances and don't embarrass everybody, we can pop all the pills and smoke all the grass we want. I look normal, sure, and they'll accept any of my friends that looked normal. They don't really have that much of a choice. They know I could get up in the morning and hitch all the way to California, and they never see me again.
Yeah, I love the they used like the threat of them leaving as the reason for them to be terrible.
But that's what they're talking about at the time. This is the reason why Dean Corll ended up getting away with what he did for so long, is that there were so many runaways, because you're in this shit-fuck town in the middle of Texas, and basically, if I lived there, the first thing I would do every day is wake up and be like, how the fuck do I get out of here?
Right.
And a really quick way is to meet Dean Corll and his two teenage boys, and they'll get you out of there real fast.
In a body bag.
Yeah, this was the perfect place for Dean Corll to operate. He could not have asked for better killing grounds.
Well, we talk about this is a common example. It's what happened with Edmund Kemper. It happened like these, the same things. It's these idyllic little towns where it's vulnerable.
Yeah.
It's ready for somebody to come in and take advantage of these social agreements that everybody set up. I mean, like, well, this kind of shit just doesn't happen here.
Yeah, it's That's what everyone says, like, well, maybe, have you noticed all these kids going missing? I don't know, maybe someone's behind this, and everyone just goes, nah.
I saw Becky Sue wobbling a little bit more the other day. I think they were just running train over her by the water tower.
We gotta do something. It seems like a very fun place to be a teenager, I have to say.
And meanwhile,
just drink and get stoned all day,
And Becky Sue is just being like, where's all these boys who used to run train on me?
Yeah, that's it. She's the real victim here.
Now, let's get back to the story of Dean Corll. With the candy factory officially out of business, Dean started working full-time at Houston Power and Lighting, testing electrical relays, and he moved into a shed across the street from Cooley Elementary School. Mm. And there, he installed a blacklight, a TV, a stereo, and a primitive alarm system that would flash a red light in his bedroom for anyone to show up at his shed unannounced.
Party house.
I mean, this is a web. Like, that, he is a spider attracting flies. He knows exactly what he's doing. He's been doing this since the candy factory.
Well, think about Michael Jackson creating the stuffed bear room that it led to the side.
Well, Michael Jackson wasn't a pedophile.
Whatever he
was. I have
was.
To agree with Marcus
well,
on
let's
this
just
one, but we're
say,
not going to get into that
let's
right
Let's just
now.
Call him the greatest child entertainer of all time. Let's call him the Tina Turner private dancer of all child entertainers.
He didn't do it. The teddy bears weren't for the kids. The teddy bears were for him.
We're not starting the conversation about Michael Jackson right now.
He was a great host for children. But the idea is that you build this place. What else does a 15-year-old Texas run almost pre-runaway.
Not even Texas. This is every teen. In 1970, this is every teenager
in
America.
He's literally got all the coolest shit you want. He's technically used to have a pool table, which means at any point he could have another pool table.
That's right.
He's got a black light. Cool. Done.
Awesome.
Led Zeppelin with a black light going. You're done.
Boom.
A full-on TV.
Yes.
And he's got a security light. Boys, spend an hour just going, like, is light on yet? Oh, wait, let me get run away farther. Is light on yet? All right, let me run closer. Is light on yet? Damn, that is just the funnest goddamn way to. Handcuffs are getting real tight, Dean.
It'll happen. Yeah, all you need is a black light and a couch and the allowing people to use drugs in your house. And
yeah.
It's the coolest house for a 15-year-old to be in.
Yeah, you can straight up rape any boy in there that you want. Yeah.
Well,
yeah, so you just got to set it up. Dad, you put it out there, put some chips.
I don't know.
Well, really, I mean, most of the boys who regularly hung out at Dean's place, they had fond-ish memories of the time that they spent there. They said that he was kind of weird. A lot of the kids noticed that he got a little giddy around the teenage boys. But for the most part, they said that they thought Dean was just a quote-unquote good dude.
Well, another thing mm-hmm. they said about him were that he was completely and totally anonymous and seemed like a shadow.
Yeah.
That was the other way they sort of put it. We'll go into that more when the trio was all together. But he was also like a nobody.
Mm-hmm.
They were like, they went to his house and partied all the time. And they would go and they would like do whatever. But Dean was just kind of a puppeteer or like around them, like kind of being like, oh, here's a toy and here's some weed and here's some booze.
But didn't we all have a house like this that we used to go to in our teens? I mean, I know for a fact there was a house that was owned by a 27-year-old who I believe was still a freshman in college. And we would go over there and do everything we ever wanted to do. And now that I think about it, he was relatively creepy.
Yeah, we had a ton of people. Like, we had so many older dudes that were in their early to mid-20s, some of them in their late 20s, early 30s, just buy beer for all the kids.
Right,
and they would hang out with all the kids, and the kids at the time, you're like, oh, yeah, he's cool.
But every once in a while, when you're hanging around Tom, and it's like fucking maybe like 2 or 3 in the morning, he's just like, you know, Marcus, you're one of the good ones.
They fucked the teenage girls. Those were the guys that were fucking like the 16, 17-year-old girls that it was a love-hate relationship mm-hmm. because they'd buy us beer, but then they'd also take all of the girls, and there was not that many girls. There were 12 kids in the class. There were 5 girls.
No. So they're rapists, essentially. The 30-year-olds having sex with 16-year-olds.
I never realized how creepy Matthew McConaughey's character was in Dazed and Confused until right now. This is exactly what he was doing.
See, Natalie grew up, had a punk house or something like that, but all the guys never had sex with the kid. There was no sex in the house. It was just more like trash and stuff and throwing things around, but I think it's a punk thing.
Well, a punk's totally different. Punk, they've got ideals and shit like that. Like, they're trying to make a point. They're trying to make a point.
I got out of the punk movement as soon as I realized there are more rules in the punk movement than most prisons. I mean, it's crazy how many rules there are. Apparently, you can't get over 6'3", otherwise you're out. So I'm 4 inches too tall. I swear to God, as soon as I got tall, they're like, you are intimidating us. You better go.
I could see the children's book now, like the saddest, tallest punk.
Fuck, yeah, exactly.
He's walking through and be like, all the jeans I saw that are long on everybody else are fit perfect on me. I look square.
I don't need green hair to stand out.
No, as far as we know, Dean didn't kill any kids during these 2 years, from 1968 to 1970, when kids were kind of coming in and out and hanging out at his house with the cool black light and the alarm. Nor did his parties get as rowdy as they would down the line when his crew was complete. What we do know is that this is when Dean would pick up his first accomplice, David Brooks.
Now, he is a weird-looking kid.
Super weird. And he's also the one that we know the least about, because he's the one... He's still alive. He's still in prison.
But he will not talk to anybody.
Will not talk. And even his confessions were kind of curt. Like, he only confessed to so much. But yeah, Wayne Henley will talk to anybody.
Oh, he is a bit of a whore for the camera. And I would also say Wayne Henley kind of coerced... coerced David Brooks into confessing with him. Wayne Henley kind of pulled them all in. Again, this is a part of the reason why, like, I just feel like if you're going to be killing a bunch of boys, a lot of times you're going to have a couple of boy henchmen, and I think that John Wayne Gacy probably also had a couple of boy henchmen, but they were wise enough / stupid enough to not tell anybody.
What is it if you don't speak as opposed to speaking? What's more egotistical? You know, like, what's worse?
What, claiming the crime, saying, oh, I did it? That's like a terrorist.
Or just refusing to talk about it, though. Then the victim's families get no closure
Because refusing to talk about it makes you a good criminal and a bad person. Talking about the crimes and owning them technically makes you a showboat, but in some queer way, you can change it for yourself that you're giving people validation and closure.
Well, I've got some theories about David Brooks that we're probably going to get into on the next episode.
Right.
As far as your question goes there, Ben, but we need to get a little bit more information about the guy before we really get into it. Now, Brooks was, of course, from from a broken home and had known Dean from the time that David was 10 years old, back when Dean was just the nice man with the candy across the street from his school. But now that Dean was finally away from the prying eyes of his mother and the other candy factory employees, he could finally give in to the urges that have been just barely kept under wraps for so many years.
And now we're going to see how many killers that were really close with their family, and how it's sort of like they can't blossom. Because what they say about Dean before is that he was incredibly polite. He would never say no. He would do anything his mother asked him to do. He was devoted son, devoted to his family, devoted to the candy business. And then as soon as she was gone, same thing with Ed Gein, same thing sort of with Jeffrey Dahmer when he finally moved away from his family, when you finally start seeing them being like, I'm free. I can finally like let my hair down and I can get those toe rings. Right. I see all the other girls have.
I do want to clarify, there is never a nice guy who works in the chocolate factory across from the school.
Never trust him. Never do it.
No, do not.
Any parent, again, do not trust the man who sells candy ever. They are killers. They are some rapists.
If you are a mayor of a small town and there is a candy factory across from a school,
shut it down.
Shut it down. Shut one of them down.
But first of all, just get all the candy.
Yeah.
And keep it in yourself and sit on it like you're Willy Wonka.
That's right.
Coral started taking advantage of the 14-year-old Brooke, paying him sometimes $5, sometimes $10 for blowjobs, Dean giving, Brooks taking. And Brooks's former attorney, a man named Jim Skelton, said that Brooks absolutely idolized Dean, who Brooks said was the first person to accept him for who he was, because Brooks' father pretty much hated him. He called him a sissy. He said that, you know, he was no son of his. And really, Dean Coral was the first one to ever be nice to him.
I mean, David's father was dead wrong. If I was David, I'd be like, I am getting paid to have my dick sucked.
Do you have any idea
what is more masculine than that?
How fucking kick-ass that? How Motley Crue is that?
Are you crazy?
Now, less than a year after their first quote-unquote encounter, David Brooks moved in with Dean Coral and would soon become one of Dean Coral's two accomplices. It all began in mid-December 1970 when Brooks walked in unannounced on Dean molesting two young boys who were tied to Dean's infamous torture board. While we don't know if the torture board cops eventually found was the original, the final design was a 7 by 3 foot inch slab of thick unpainted plywood with holes drilled into each of the four corners. Handcuffs were used for the wrists, while the ankles were bound with nylon rope. The boys would be sexually assaulted and tortured for hours, sometimes days, until they were finally put out of their misery by either strangulation or a simple shot to the head with a pistol.
My name's Dan Trathers, and I have made several of these boards with the handcuffs at the top and the nylon cords at the bottom, and they were never meant ever once to be used as a torture rack in any way, shape, or form. It was supposed to be used to simulate riding a sled in your imagination. And I am appalled that my invention of that came from a childhood dream of mine in the sandy deserts of the middle of Texas,
right,
that I could never see snow, yearn to sled because of pictures I've seen on the side of Christmas cookie containers. And I invented this, what I like to call the ready sled.
Right.
And I am just, I cannot believe the way my dream has been turned into a nightmare.
How much money have you made selling the sled?
Well, since Dean Coral?
Yeah.
$75 million.
Isn't that something?
Selling them in Mumbai.
Isn't that
right?
Oh,
yeah. They're just like hotcakes. China, hotcakes.
Are they being used as torture racks, do you think, or...
I have found it useful to my liberty to elect to not ask certain questions.
Oh, good. Yeah. That reminds me of the person who invented the drone we talked about on Top End for tuna fishermen. And now you can see what they're doing.
5,000 dead bodies later.
Yep.
Now, Brooks, upon initially walking in on Dean Coral in the middle of one of these sessions, turned around and left immediately, stayed away for a day or two. But having no place else to go, Brooks returned to the house where Dean explained to him that he was just a part of a child pornography ring.
Oh.
And that he had been paid to produce child pornography.
Oh, it's a job.
Yeah. Oh, I'm so sorry. I judged you.
And then after that, he just shipped him off to California.
Yeah, and they were going to the... the child pornography ranch in the sky where they could run and play.
But at some point, we don't really know why, but at some point, Coral just fessed up and told Brooks that actually, no, he wasn't a part of a child pornography ring. He was actually just a murderer.
Just a plain old murderer.
That's just, but you know, nefarious are your actions if the excuse is it's just part of a child pedophile ring? Like, that's the cover-up lie?
Well, he started with it, but it's how you grade it out. He started by telling him he was a human trafficker.
Yeah.
And that he was selling these guys in from other countries, and he was helping them emigrate. Like, that was one story. Then it turned into child pornography. Then it turned into being like, well, you know, I am not as regal as all I've said before. But now... But what's really interesting with Brooks is that by now it's just he's just in too far.
Right.
Now it's like what he can do then is sort of being like he can relax his cover story and be like, okay, no, I can do this because now he can see he's ready to flip and he can use him to be his accomplice.
Yeah. And Coral's hold over Brooks, his hold had to have been so powerful. Because the next time that Coral struck was on December 13th, 1970, and Brooks was right there alongside to help him.
Well, and the same thing as we said about Charles Manson, and I'll say this too about Dean Coral, I don't believe that anybody is a perfect puppeteer. I don't think anybody's a puppet master. I don't think anybody is that inscrutable of a Svengali, right? I think a lot of times these people are already 50% of the way there. They already have the impulses, and you as a person who's been watching kids and profiling kids and grooming kids to be your victims for fucking 20 years, now look at someone being like, I see the mirror image of myself. I know that if I talk with this guy, we can hook up. It's kind of like meeting somebody that you're in a band with or in a sketch comedy group with, where you meet someone and be like,
equating getting Murder Fist together that you guys did in theater school in college with Dean Coral collecting boys to then murder other boys.
It's all
boys.
Collaboration, man.
I see. Okay, which is a bit of a... One does sketch comedy and sort of makes people laugh.
But you click.
Right.
Now, in addition to the emotional hold that Coral had over Brooks, there was a financial aspect of the relationship as well. Coral told Brooks that he would give him $200 for every boy that he could lure back to their apartment, and Brooks took to the idea almost immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And besides just the money, Brooks was also rewarded with a 1968 green Corvette on his 16th birthday, ensuring his loyalty for years to come.
Right, and also, I mean, when you mentioned David Brooks, he's in too deep. It's similar to what people theorize about, like, Bohemian Grove and places like that. Once you see people make, you know, do atrocities to another person or, you know, Skull and Bones, then you're now implicated in it as well. So what are you supposed to do?
You're an accessory to the crime.
Oh, right. But that's what he did with Wayne Hendley. Wayne Hendley talks about that after. We'll talk about that. But he's basically said, like, Dean Coral is like, well, you're already accomplished to murder. So as soon as I confess that the guys that you've been showing up with, I've been murdering, you're already done. You're already in. So you might as well get your jollies with it. And you also know if you play along, you probably won't end up on the torture rack.
Yeah, that's
as long as you're
true.
Looking at the torture rack, you're not going to end up on the torture rack.
And that's just looking. Probably. Yeah. That's not guaranteed. That's just probably.
And again, these Houston cops are just like, did you do it? And if David Brooks would go in and be like, hey, I have to report a crime, they'd be like, did you do it? He'd be like, yes. And then they just arrest him.
Oh, yeah, he's done.
There.
He's already done. Yeah, it's all locked in.
So the first murders that we know that Brooks participated in was that of James Glass and Danny Yates. Glass had been to Dean's house before, hanging out, and was actually a friend of David Brooks. So it wasn't any big deal to him. You know, Brooks pulled up. He was like, hey, we're hanging out at Dean's. You want to come? And the two kids were like, yeah, let's go. And James and Danny would also be the first boys that Brooks would help bury in Coral's infamous boat shed. Dean had rented a dirt floor storage facility just a few months before this double murder. And this storage facility was conveniently located less than a mile from where Dean worked.
And this also, again, shows the impenetrable, like, lack of interest of someone who's getting paid $4 an hour to work at the storage shed facility while Dean Coral's coming in and out covered in sweat with shovels being like, just making the storage shed deeper. Just gotta make it deeper, you know? Sometimes you're just like, oh, I'm looking at this shed and it could be a fuck ton more deeper, you know what I'm saying? You know,
more
and he's
shed.
Just, the guy is just flipping a magazine, not hearing anything.
Yeah, he just flips a quarter on the way out and tells the guy to keep the change, and the guy's like, this technically is change.
Yeah. And it also kind of, this is a weird thing about Dean Coral, is that it was less than a mile from where he worked, so he could dispose of bodies on his way to work. He could just put one of the bodies in his van, take it out there, take care of a quick errand before going and testing relays for 8 hours.
Mm-hmm. So I got to wake up 28 minutes early for work tomorrow. Got to dispose the body before I go in.
Am I talking out loud? Oh, David, oh, I got to come clean to you. Oh.
So 6 weeks after that double murder, Brooks and Coral lured another couple of kids, 15-year-old Donald Waldrop and his 13-year-old brother, Jerry, to the apartment where Brooks looked on as Dean strangled them both to death. And a couple of months after that, Brooks convinced another friend of his, 15-year-old Randall Harvey, to let him and Dean give him a ride to work in Dean's white, windowless Econoline van. Now, the van was a torture facility all in itself. Rings and hooks protruded from pegboard walls, and when cops finally found and searched the van after Dean was killed, they found binoculars, a portable two-way radio, and 15 feet of nylon rope.
And now, my name is Dylan Triegel, and when I had originally designed the inside Acrobat van, I never expected to be turned. I am appalled at the turn of events that have happened with the sales of some of these vans. They were meant for aerial acrobatic tricks inside of a van people that are traveling across the country and are bored.
How many of those did you sell?
I have made upwards of $97 million
interesting.
Selling these vans across the country. And again, I'm happy people are bringing acrobatics to the small town of America using the rings and hooks and binoculars provided inside of these vans.
Do you find that most frumpy mid-30s Texan men like
all
to do
them.
Acrobatics?
Yeah, it's all acrobatic. Of them. It's actually a surprise because you'd look at some of these men and be like, you look more of a molester than an acrobat. But again, I have found best in my interest of my liberty and also financial security to not ask certain questions about the nature of the use of my inside acrobatic act vans.
I'll take three.
Now, after this boy Randall was secured in the van, the two took him back to the apartment where Dean raped him, tortured him, and shot him in the head, after which Coral and Brooks took the body to the dirt floor storage shed and buried him. Now, it's important to note at this point that Brooks maintains to this day that he did not actively participate in a single murder. He says that his only roles in the murders was the capture or luring of the boys, and in the disposal of the bodies.
Isn't that the most important thing? He brought the product.
Yeah, it's the hardest shit.
Right?
Yeah.
So I feel like he's more
guilty.
He's
the dealer.
Right. Anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
I don't know if he's more guilty. Dean Coral definitely did the hard part of it.
I don't know. If you're a cattle rancher, killing the cow and butchering it and making it edible for people or whatever, that's more difficult than serving it up to them on a burger.
We're
isn't
starting
it?
To sound like the Bilderberg Group.
Yeah,
talking about people like they're cattle.
Of course, Dean, he was killing months before David came on board as his official assistant. Dean's presumed first victim was a University of Texas student by the name of Jeffrey Conan, who was picked up while hitchhiking on September 25th, 1970. I think that the disposal of Jeffrey Conan's body suggests that Dean was an old hand at the murder game by the time Conan was killed. When police found his body, they discovered that it had been covered with a layer of lime and had been wrapped in plastic.
See, nowadays you can pretty much say, like, oh, he Googled it. Because I'm certain there are, like, forums that would tell you how to dispose of a body.
Oh,
honestly, I've never researched it. But you can. Don't. But you can.
We'll be on a watch list.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. But he had to have had some experience.
He had to. Yeah. I mean, it's very possible that he had killed a boy, buried the body, and the body was found. But because Houston police don't investigate murders, he didn't get caught.
I just want to hear one hitchhiking story where it's like, I thumbed my way to San Francisco, had a great time for a week, and thumbed my way back to Stevens Point, Wisconsin, had a wonderful time.
No, there are people
that's all.
That
I just want to hear
stories.
One pot. Is there ever, has there been a good hitchhiking story?
Only men today that look like us.
Yeah,
like we are the only people who
survive.
Oh,
the people who also look like the people who kill hitchhikers?
Yes.
Yeah, did you never read On the Road? Full of great hitchhiking stories.
Oh, he came from money.
And they were all on Benzedrine.
Yeah.
So the other thing about Jeffrey Conan that suggests that this wasn't Dean's first kill was that he had been gagged with a piece of cloth, was tied hand and foot, he was naked, and strangled to death. Now, knowing what we know about serial killers, all signs point towards this being anything but Dean's first kill, both in the process of it and in the disposal of the body.
Yeah, because it seems like he's pretty far along in his fantasy at this point, and so he knows what he wants.
Yeah, and a lot of people think that Wayne Henley and David Brooks weren't his first assistants. That he had been working with a couple of kids before that who hadn't quite worked out. He murdered them and brought on a couple of new boys.
It's really hard. That's a problem with being the young boy assistant to a man who murders young boys, is that the turnaround.
Yeah, it's through the roof. Yeah.
Now, after Randall Harvey, Coral, with the assistance of Brooks, would commit another double murder, their third in less than 6 months. Every single one of these six boys lived in the same 2.5 square mile neighborhood where Dean had set up shop, the Heights. Now, to be fair to the parents, who actually gave a shit about the kids who were going missing, because not all the parents gave a fuck when their kids went missing. A lot of them were like, whew, I don't got to deal with that piece of shit anymore.
It's either their piece of shit or the straight up fact of, like, we barely had enough money to raise this kid too, which is an even more heartbreaking thing.
Right.
We like look at it and be like, we were struggling when our son went missing. We can easily accept the idea that he ran away.
Yeah, he went to California and played in a jug band. Yes. He's doing really well, from what I can imagine.
He got picked up on the side of the road to go to work on some fucking truck yard or doing something. Right.
He's
like,
working on an oil rig. He got some sort of, and the only thing they can hope for is a letter a couple of months or a couple of years later with $5 in it saying, hey, sorry I had to leave. I've been working on an oil rig out in the Gulf for the last 2 years.
Yeah.
Here's what I can contribute. But really, these families, they had a lot going against them. First of all, back to the Houston Police Department, the missing persons department didn't actually look for anyone. Their only purpose was to inform families if the police department happened to come across the missing person in question, either through arrest or through death.
So they just took that literally. They were just like, this is where the missing persons... But not looking for them? No, it's just we just identify missing persons.
It's just, that guy's not there anymore.
Yep.
So there's a hat there. I see some pants. I see some shoes. I don't see a man. He's not there.
He's missing.
And second, of course, as we've been hammering home again and again, not just in this episode, but in the Ed Kemper episode, in the Manson episode, cops all over the country in the 60s and 70s, they didn't look for runaways, especially in poor areas, because it was just generally assumed that if teenagers went missing, they ran away to California or New York City or wherever.
And I will put this as a sort of conspiratorial view of this, is that I think that this is where there's a problem almost, is that you could disappear back in the day.
Yes.
You could just go live your life and not be entirely supervised and entirely surveilled everywhere you went. This is now... this fear of these kind of crimes, stuff like allowing Dean Coral to murder 29 boys... directly correlates to our surveillance period, with this idea now being like, now no one can get away anonymously. Now you can't.
No one can have a torture rack where they murder a bunch of teenagers in their shed by the school, Henry.
But there's the mixture, and again, you know, it's the fine balance between security and freedom.
Yeah, say you have a reasonable police force. Then maybe these things don't happen. Maybe if you have enough cops for when a family calls and says, hey, my kid is missing, here are some clues, could you look for them?
Yeah.
Because there were clues. If cops would have actually looked into this case.
Because Dean Coral kept popping up in each one of these stories.
In all these stories that he kept popping up, and they could have easily put the pieces together long before this, if only they would have had a reasonable police force. Because a reasonable police force is needed.
All right. Then what you do is that you start with a paltry police force, and then everyone complains that there are no police and they're not doing their job. And then when you start rolling in tanks and drones, now we're like, we got plenty of police. Now we got so many police, we're gonna fucking frisk you. You fell asleep in the train, we're checking your goddamn pockets.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah. You know. What we're saying is there is a happy medium.
A bit of a leap from what happened in Ferguson. And
I have been known. People have said that my opinions can be extreme, but I view myself as more of an ultra realist.
Yeah, but I do agree. There is a slippery slope, and over policing is certainly a problem right now in the country.
And it's not just over policing. It's also, you know, you have something like Dean Coral that leads directly to the satanic panic. You know, it leads to, like, you start getting this pedophile hysteria. This missing child hysteria that starts...
Which is not like the hysteria over over Lady Gaga.
That's right.
Nor is it like the Def Leppard album, Hysteria.
And then, of course, Big Milk started putting kids on cartons to sell products.
Selling
Everyone's
milk.
Like, gotta collect all the missing kids. Playing with them like Pokemon.
Well, another reason why these parents can't really be blamed is that while the height was small, it wasn't that small. I'm not exactly sure of the population numbers of the Heights in 1970, but currently, the Heights sits at about 15,000 people. And these parents, they didn't necessarily talk to each other. And there, of course, back then, there wasn't any internet to spread the word.
Right, right, right.
And
I'm gonna do the. I'm doing the quick math as to how many. What percentage is 30 people out of 15,000?
Let's do quick math with Henry Zebrowski. He's got his calculator out.
I mean, it's a 0.00%.
And he doesn't know how to use it.
I don't know how to do it.
He literally, I don't even know if we're going to keep this portion in. I do want to clarify, Henry does not know how to do quick math, even on a calculator.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I don't either.
Wow. Stunningly stupid, Henry Zebrowski.
Do you?
What's that?
Do you know how to find a percentage?
I also didn't stop the show to do it. So I will say, yes, I do, and I will not be proven wrong because I will not attempt to do it.
Let me just try this, all right? It's 30 divided by 15,000, all right? That's how you'd figure that out. 0.002. All right, cool. You're right. I just wanted to see.
A point.
All this. None of this.
You have to just hit a button.
Oh, it's staying in.
Good Lord. All right.
Now, the fourth reason, as we said earlier, there were no newsmakers in the Heights. Kids who went missing, they didn't show up on the 10 o'clock news. They didn't show up on the front page of the paper. These kids were just gone. And, of course, Dean Corll knew this. Mm. But the first kids who actually got some notice came next. Victims, I think they're 9 and 10. David Hillegeist and his neighbor Gregory Winkle went missing on May 29th, 1971, and the Hillegeist family pulled out as many stops as a poor family in the Heights could afford. After receiving no help from the cops, the Hillegeist hired a private investigator to search for their son. And the only lead that the PI came up with is that the kids might have been abducted by a pimp named Chicken Joe, who operated out of Dallas. But of course, that tip didn't pan out at all. But this is yet another injustice in this story. When the cops, who refused to help the Hillegeist family, found out about the help they were receiving from the PI, they opened an investigation into the PI's credentials, hauled the PI into court for an expired license, and spent thousands of dollars prosecuting him instead of spending a single cent, a single second, looking for David Hillegeist.
I'm going to say the PI probably already knew he was going to suggest that Chicken Joe stole the kid.
Oh, yeah,
I think that the PI is just like, I'll just say Chicken Joe stole him again and collect my paycheck.
Well, Chicken Joe is also, a chicken is a prison term for a pedophile.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, Chicken Joe. Now, the PI did actually put in quite a bit of time, and even when the Hillegeist ran out of money, he still did work for them.
Which is really very sad. And the Hillegeist family, the story of the Hillegeist family and the man with the candy is incredible. It's brutally sad. It ruined their whole life. They spent all of their money on the PI. Then they started getting into psychics that were taking them back and forth, like saying stuff like, I see him staring out of a window somewhere in San Antonio. And they would go to San Antonio and look for him for days. And then it's all of it. They were just dragged around, these poor, poor people.
It's felonious, those psychics. I really do despise those people who prey on wounded souls.
I think they went to 6 different psychics. And of course, each psychic charges them a little bit of money.
Just immediately, if you meet a psychic, say, how many Skittles do I have in my pocket? Always have 7. If they answer any other number than 7, they're not a good psychic.
No, it was really, and this is what we're talking about when we say if the Houston PD would have investigated this at all, Corll would have started coming up. The Hillegeist, in hindsight, they did think about Dean Corll. Their son was one of the dozens of kids who had regularly visited the candy factory in the mid-60s. But Dean's parents, when their son was hanging out there, rather than being concerned that their son was hanging around with this strange older guy, they were more concerned that the boy might just be bothering a man who was trying to go about his business. Which, this was exactly how my childhood was.
Yeah, yeah. The onus used to be on the child.
Yeah.
Right?
Of course.
Oh, yeah. That was what we were talking about with teachers. There was a thing, I was reading some article somewhere about how, like, you know, teachers get blamed for their kids failing in school nowadays, where
right.
it used to be like, I used to get very much so punished if yes. I fucked up.
Yeah,
yeah
me
of course.
Too.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And I used to have that all the time. You know, I grew up in a small town where your parents would just kind of, in the summertime, they just let you go into the town. Just like, yep, go out, fuck around. Don't mm-hmm. bother me for 8 hours. Be back here by 3 p.m.
And it's another case where I think we have to come back to a middle ground.
Yeah. And that's what would happen is that, you know, you'd yeah. just go to, you just swing by a bar and you'd swing by like a mechanic shop and you just kind of like, hey, mister, how you doing? What's going on? And
get out of here, kid. You're getting dust all over my bar bottles.
Well, really, right. they'd, but they'd be like, you know, you're breaking up the monotony of a 10-hour work day. So the guy's like, hey, come on over here, little fart, you little fart. And then they'd
weird times yeah. in Marcus's childhood.
The 90s.
Yeah, yeah, it was a strange decade. There's yeah, no doubt about that.
The 90s was a super strange decade. But the other run-in that David Hillegeist had with Dean Corll was a few years after, you know, he had been, you know, hanging out at the candy factory. She found him again playing pool there. And she told Dean, listen, I would appreciate it if you didn't let my son hang around here anymore. But Dean, he alleviated her fears by saying, like, hey, your neighbor, Jerry Winkle, she works here part-time. Her son, Gregory, he works here too. And Gregory would be the boy that was killed alongside David Hillegeist on May 29th.
Mm.
And he would also be the first of two former candy factory employees to die at the hands of Dean Corll. And in a desperate attempt to find their son, the Hillegeist family canvassed Houston with posters bearing David's name and picture. The whole neighborhood pitched in, but none more than one of David Hillegeist's oldest friends, Elmer Wayne Henley Jr. And while Wayne Henley at the time had no idea who killed his friend, within 6 months of that disappearance, Wayne Henley would become Dean Corll's second accomplice in 18 more murders over the course of less than a year.
Mm. Technically, Dean Corll is a job creator.
I guess so. I guess
so. It's just interns. Yeah.
My
goodness. You know, we have an intern. Travis would kill for us.
He would not kill for us, and nor will we request him to. Good God. Is that the episode for today?
That's it for today.
Wow, what a story.
Next episode, we're going to come back with Wayne Henley, and we're going to get to where it really ramps up.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
And it's, we're going to do some talking about what it really means to be a sexual sadist and where that shit comes from, that horrible, horrible shit that makes you a monster that should be buried in a concrete square 20 feet mm-hmm. underground.
If you are, if you do work in law enforcement, go knock on a shed's door if it's by a school.
If you
just
see a shed
what's
by
going
a school,
on, just knock on it, see if it's the janitor's house.
Go to a candy shop. Honestly,
sniff around.
If you see around, smash a couple of things with a baton and just be like, just checking up, just wanting to see, just want to make sure nothing bad's going on here. Oh, you got nothing going on in the pralines. You just go digging through your hands through the pralines and then take a handful and eat them in front of them, being like, I can come back anytime I want. Come back. Start scare candy people.
Yeah.
Everybody.
I know
if you're not a police officer.
That's it.
If you see a candy shop, go in there and be like, I know what you did.
Yeah. That's who we should be stopping and frisking.
Candy shop owners.
Yeah.
I agree. All right, good. Well, I think we're solving problems here. Very nice. Thanks so much for listening here to this episode. I'm just going to throw out a hail yourselves.
Yeah.
Because you guys have been so unbelievable. The Patreon page is incredible. Thank you so much.
Oh, my God. Yeah, if you want to contribute to our Patreon campaign, go to patreon.com/lastpodcastontheleft. It really is starting to turn into a life-changing amount of money, guys.
It really is.
This is fantastic.
It's incredible.
For those that listened to a couple of Roundtable of Gentlemen ago, I got a phone call from City Capital One.
Did you pay it off?
I paid it off,
ladies
and gentlemen, because of your wonderful contributions to the Patreon. Yeah. So thank you.
And I've almost got all my credit card debt paid off as well. This is fantastic. You're just alleviating burdens. You're making life better for us, where we can spend even more time devoted to Last Podcast on the Left, including doing live shows, which we will be doing one on March 5th in Baltimore at Auto Bar, along with The Cowmen, the band in which I play drums and also Hold McNeely from the Round Table of Gentlemen, sings in. That
conveniently
is
booked alongside us.
Intriguing.
Yeah, fuckers.
Not bad. Not bad at
we're
all.
We're going to hear a Cowmen song at the end of this episode in case you guys are new to them. And, of course, if you want your Last Podcast on the Left t-shirt, go to cavecomedyradio.com/merch. If you want to order t-shirts for yourself, of the same quality that we have ours, of course, go to jackprince.com. And I'd say I got something new going on right now that I would like to announce, that I would like to direct people towards. I just started doing radio again. I just started a new radio program called The Lucky Bone Show.
And it's very good.
Nice. The Lucky Bone Show. Thank you, Henry.
What
Thank
is The Lucky Bone Show all about, Marcus?
I just play music and I talk. It's a radio show.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, it's like, you know, it's like FM radio, except no commercials.
That's great.
Yeah, and you can find that at mixcloud.com. Just go to mixcloud.com and search The Lucky Bone Show. I'm going to be putting out one, maybe two a week. I love doing it so much. It feels so good to be back on radio. And thank you, everyone so far who's listened to the show and had such kind words to say about
it. If you make out while listening to it, it kind of feels like you're in the back of a 1950s car.
Ooh, that's exciting.
Except it's, you know, you're listening to the Stooges and, you know, the Dixie Cups. Yeah.
And if you want to hear about other sociopaths, we do a political show called Abling and Top Bat. We'll be with you throughout the entire process here in 2016. It's really heating up.
It's heating up,
It'll
man.
Be fun.
And so, and follow us on Instagram and at LP on the left, which is fair. And also, I want to give a shout out to a guy called Titty Bats on Instagram, who I love his fucking shirts. Titty Bats and Paul Bearer Press. Oh. Which I fucking love these shirts.
What kind of shirts are they?
One's it's got bats with titties on them.
Oh, it's
and the other one
literal.
Does a bunch of horror t-shirts. It's pretty sweet. I got one Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It's Leatherface, but there's all Japanese writing around it.
Oh, nice. Very cool. And find Henry on Twitter at Henry Loves You. Find Marcus Parks on Twitter at Marcus Parks. I'm at Twitter at Ben Kissel.
Oh, and also congratulations to everyone for hitting 10,000 members in the Facebook group.
That's
Hail
wonderful.
Satan.
Yeah, and I also want to give a nice thank you to Sarah Richard, who sent us each of us a set of DC Comics Justice League tarot cards.
And it's really fucking cool.
They're really fucking cool. You can see Sarah Richard's art at sarahrichard.com. I love everything that she's doing. She draws a hell of an owl. I'll say that much.
Well, that's
have you been masturbating to her pictures of owls?
I mean, I've
we better wrap it up. We can't get to the truth on that one.
Oh, man. And, yeah, you guys, thank you so much as always. You know, Heil Gein.
I'll mean
hail yourselves once again.
Hail Satan. Enjoy him. He gives you gifts. Sorry, goodbye.
And enjoy this song from the Cowmen.
It's called Go Fuck Yourself.
No, it's not.
It's not. We have no song. Our songs have profanity, but not the titles.
Well, there was a preacher rode into town. The town. He found a lot by the cancer buzz tomb across.